Well, good morning. I'm glad to be here with you this morning. I wanted to take just a little bit to introduce myself so you know who I am, where I'm coming from. So my name's Nathan Walters. You can take a Sharpie and correct it if you want. My wife Jamie and my son Nate, I don't think she's in here. He made it through Sunday school this morning without a nap, but at 7 months old, a nap is pretty crucial in the morning, so I think he's elsewhere catching some Z's, and I hope you don't do the same thing in the next couple minutes here. So I'm the new state director here in Maryland and Delaware, and I'm on campus pretty much all the time, especially during this semester at University of Delaware. If you knew Blake Hardcastle before he was in this role, before I was. So just a little bit of my story, which very much revolves around collegiate ministry. So I grew up in the church. I was familiar with all the stories of the Bible. My grandfather actually pastored the church I grew up in, so we were very, very well connected. But in college, I ended up kind of making some friends who were involved with Baptist Student Ministry at the University of Delaware. And I didn't realize it at the time, but it wasn't until I got involved with the ministry, got in kind of real community with other believers who were kind of talking about the hard things of the Bible together, that I realized, man, I don't really know why I believe what I believe. So it was really through BSM at Delaware, through making friends who took the Bible seriously, who wanted to read together and talk about what they were learning, that I really, really began to grow in my faith. So I kind of grew exponentially from my sophomore year through my senior year. And between my junior and senior year, I spent 2 months in Indonesia on a missions trip. We were really sharing the gospel with people who had never heard before. We went to a few islands where, and we were the first people from outside the island to come there, much less to share the gospel with them. So I think especially through that, I started kind of toward my senior year to think, I think something with ministry full-time is where I want to end up. I was studying civil engineering at the time, going toward my senior year, so it kind of made sense to finish my bachelor's, and got married to Jamie right after I graduated in 2014. Graduated in May, got married in November. So I ended up taking an engineering job for 4 years out of school. And now we always tell students, you know, if your calling is to work a secular job and to, you know, work with your local church and do ministry, that's good. Not everyone has to do full-time ministry. You know, we push people toward that if that's what they're called toward. But I didn't have it in my mind, like, I need to be, you know, full-time paid on BCMD staff to do ministry. I realized I can do that in, you know, the secular world. So I took a job in civil engineering, but as the years went on, started to realize this is not where God has called me. This is all well and good for now, but it's not where I wanted to be long term. So I started to take classes through Southern Seminary online in 2016, and just this fall of last year, I quit my engineering job and I took a kind of an internship position at Ogletown, my home church up in Newark. And then, within a few months of taking that, Blake approached me and said he was leaving. I'd known for a little bit that he was kind of looking around elsewhere, but that all kind of became cemented in the fall of last year, and he approached me about taking this position, which, I mean, I think any position that you take where someone was doing it for 20-plus years before that is a little intimidating for a 28-year-old. But I'm excited now to be on campus. Semester just got started this past week, so we're kind of in the thick of things and trying to get freshmen involved. So it's definitely an exciting time. And I'm very excited to be doing something and involved in something that impacted me so greatly when I was in college. This is where my wife and I met. This is where her faith really grew. She came to school as a pretty new believer. She got saved in high school. And so it's really awesome to be involved in something that benefited me and really my family so greatly. So just kind of some quick numbers on collegiate ministry in Maryland and Delaware. I just kind of wanted to share with you guys a quick update before we get into the word this morning. So these are kind of our final numbers from last year of what happened in Maryland and Delaware. So we saw just over 3,500 students impacted by our campus ministry programs here in the state, Maryland and Delaware. And there were over so those were all the students who were kind of impacted, who came to events, who were involved, who we reached out to within the state. And then of those, just over 500, we would say were actively involved. So would say they were kind of members of a campus ministry, or, you know, if you ask them, hey, what do you do during the week? Campus ministry was something that came to mind. So these are students who were kind of actively involved. College students gave just under $100,000 to missions. And these are college students who, you know, maybe they work a part-time job. These aren't students who have a ton of money. So to give $100,000 throughout our state to missions, I think is pretty significant. 103 college students were involved in leadership development. I think in the collegiate world, this is extremely important that we're looking for students who will be the elders of churches in the future, or will go into the mission field in the future. So we had just over 100 students kind of in that pipeline of leadership development throughout the state. We saw 17 students and 2 non-students come to Christ through our collegiate efforts in the state. 178 students were involved in evangelism on campus. 312 were involved in various Bible studies that we kind of put on and fund throughout our state. And 30 of them were involved in summer or semester-long missions. Students that kind of said, yeah, this is my summer, and I'm not going to get that internship that seems like it'll be the best thing. I'm going to go share the gospel for the summer. So this morning, I don't want to just talk about collegiate ministry the whole time, although all of it kind of relates back to collegiate ministry. I want to talk through kind of gospel proclamation and multiplication, because this is really a huge aim of college ministry. We kind of try to view college campuses as mission fields, because they really are. There's students, yes, from around the U.S. that come to our college campuses, but even like at the University of Delaware right now, there's about 25,000 undergrad and graduate students, but there's another 5,000 or 6,000 students in the English language program that come from all around the world. My wife and I actually have a Chinese student that lives with us right now that's here to study English. So to even think about these college campuses as mission fields, because they are. So gospel proclamation is obviously a huge aim of collegiate ministry. But this is a huge aim of collegiate ministry because it's the aim of the church. So what I want to do this morning is kind of use Paul's greeting in Romans chapter 1, his intentions behind preaching the gospel in Rome, to show us how we may aim to share the gospel wherever we are. So our text for this morning is going to be Romans chapter 1, verses 8 through 17. And you can turn to that in your Bibles. It should be up on the screen here as well. I think it might have gotten cut off a little bit, but that's okay. Open your Bibles. That's probably your best bet. So I want to start off by reading Romans chapter 1, verses 8 through 17. Paul says, "First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you, because your faith is proclaimed in all the world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit and the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I mention you always in my prayers, asking that somehow, by God's will, I may now at last succeed in coming to you. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you, that is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that I have often intended to come to you, but thus far have been prevented, in order that I may reap some harvest among you, as well as among the rest of the Gentiles. I am under obligation both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. So I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith." So here we kind of see Paul's longing to visit Rome, and really his purpose in writing the book of Romans, which I hope you're familiar with and have read before. And now this is interesting because Paul himself has never really been to Rome. He's heard a lot about it. He's heard about, you know, as he says, their great faith that's being proclaimed throughout all the world. But he's never actually been there. He's longing to visit them. So why does Paul want to visit them is what kind of, you know, may come up first in your mind. And that's what we see first here in this passage. The first way that, you know, the reason that he wants to visit them is just to encourage and to be encouraged. So he says in verse 11, to use his gifts to strengthen their faith. He's longing to visit them to see, you know, what he can offer them to help them grow. But he's also wanting to visit, as he says in verse 12, to allow others to use the faith and the gifts that God has given them to help build him up. Paul's second purpose is simply to have a harvest. And I guess this is fitting for New Harvest in the Agricultural Museum. We're talking about harvests. And this is the language that Jesus uses in Mark chapter 4. He talks of people accepting the word and producing a crop 30, 60, 100 times what was sown. So the word is being sown and a harvest is being brought forward. So Paul is coming both to encourage believers, to be encouraged, and to reap a harvest, presumably from what's already been sown by this church in Rome. And I think it's important to note here that these things are not mutually exclusive. Paul's not just coming to, you know, encourage and be encouraged, and then on the side he's going to go separately and reap the harvest. Now, these come together. Where believers are encouraged by one another, a harvest will be sown. The gospel will spread. So you, for your church here, when you come together, even on a Sunday morning here, this happens all throughout the week, I'm sure, but as you're gathering together this morning, mutually encouraging one another through the various gifts that God has given you, the gospel will go forth from that. And if it's not, then something's not adding up. Maybe you're not mutually encouraging each other properly, but that's what happens when the encouragement happens among believers. The gospel goes forth. So not only does Paul long to preach the gospel, not only is he longing to encourage the believers there in Rome and be encouraged by them, he feels an obligation to preach the gospel. So you could kind of call that his third reason to want to visit them. He wants to encourage me, encouraged. He wants to have a harvest, but there's more than that. He wants to go because he's obligated to preach the gospel. And this word can also kind of be rendered as indebted. We can see it as kind of meaning the same thing, an obligation and indebtedness to preach the gospel. So the question once again becomes, how can Paul be indebted to people that he's never even met before? So I want to give us kind of two scenarios to help us think through this. The first is pretty simple. Say that you lend me $100. You give it to me with the intention that I'm giving it back. I am now in debt until I give it back to you, right? It's pretty simple. That's kind of the way that debt works. This is normally what we think of when we think of debt. But another scenario would be if someone else gives me $100 and says, hey, you need to give that to you. So I've been given that money from someone else, but I'm charged to give that to someone else. So every second that I'm holding that $100 and not giving it to you, I am in debt to you. And it's in this second sense that Paul is obligated to preach the gospel. This is not because the church at Rome has given him something great that now he needs to find a way to give back to them. But rather, this is because by hearing the gospel, he's obligated to share it with the entire world. If you're familiar with Paul's story, when he was once Saul and Christ appeared to him and commissioned him as an apostle, this is the beginning of Paul's indebtedness. From that moment on, he felt an obligation, like he had something that belonged to these people that he needed to give to them. So that's how Paul talks about his obligation to preach the gospel. And Paul will spend the rest of Romans explaining why exactly people need the gospel. But we see here who needs it. And this is everyone, right? I think that quote from D.A. Carson up there sums it up pretty well. He says, we are never more than poor beggars telling other poor beggars where there is bread. So because we have found bread as poor beggars, because we were looking for something, anything to really fill this need we have for God, And because we have found it in the gospel, we're obligated to bring that to others. And as Carson puts it there, we're nothing more than poor beggars telling others where there is bread. Because the gospel is the way that people are both called to faith and the way that people grow in faith. Now, you and I don't necessarily have Paul's really specific commission to be an apostle to the Gentiles. I don't presume that God appeared to you and changed your name as he did to Paul. But we do have a commission to preach the gospel and to make disciples throughout all nations. So will you treat the gospel as if it is the most valuable thing in the universe and you've been indebted to bring it to the entire world? Because certainly this is worth more than the $100 example I gave before. Do you hoard the gospel for yourself? Or do you bring this good news to others? Do you treat the gospel like it really is good news? Or do you not share it because you don't really believe that it's good news? Because that's what we're saying when we don't share the gospel. We're saying that it's not really that important. It's not really good news. So if you're like me, your answer to these questions is usually first, like, conviction. I think, oh, yeah, there were tons of chances, even for myself this week, where I could have shared and I didn't. So the question then becomes, why? What holds us back? What keeps us back from sharing with others when we know that we have the best news in the universe? You probably don't try to actively not share the gospel, right? I don't assume that any of you are out and you feel like you need to, and you're like, no, that they don't deserve it. That's usually not how it works out. It usually something gets in the way. So why does Paul remain so eager to share the gospel? I think this is really what we see in verses 16 and 17. This is because he's not ashamed of it. That's what he says. For because I am not ashamed of the gospel. And I think shame, if we really think about it, is one of the biggest enemies of gospel proclamation. Why don't we share the gospel? Because to some level, it's shameful. This is a message that is embarrassing in some ways, brings about shame onto those who we tell it to. It's offensive. The gospel brings offense. So I want to share with us kind of four ways this morning that the gospel is offensive. And hopefully by, you know, seeing these, we might realize that, oh yeah, when I share the gospel with someone, these are ways that it offends, but they are good and true. So the first way that the gospel is shameful is that it tells us that our salvation is free and undeserved. And this might not seem like a bad thing. This seems like, oh, this is great. Yes, salvation is free. You can't do anything to earn it. But what this says and why it's shameful is because it says that we are such spiritual failures that the only way that we can be saved is by a free, undeserved, and frankly, an unwanted gift. This is shameful because it offends people who think that they stand on some sort of moral high ground and they're more deserving of morally inferior people. So this offends those who think that they can be good enough and earn their salvation. The second way that the gospel is shameful is because it tells us that Jesus died for us. And once again, this doesn't seem extremely offensive, but when you think about it, what this is saying is that we are so wicked, we are so needy, that the only thing that could save us from our sin was literally God dying for us. And this offends those who believe in kind of an innate goodness in humanity. I think we see this all the time with college students that will admit, yeah, people are mostly good. We just need to kind of turn it around and we'll figure it out. And if you're familiar with any sort of world history, you know that this is not true, that we're not always on the up and up. This tells us that only the death of the Son of God could save us. We couldn't save ourselves. And not even, as we see in the Old Testament, the blood of innocent animals could do it. It had to be the Son of God. The third way that the gospel offends is that it tells us that trying to be good and spiritual isn't enough, insisting that no good person will be saved. So this offends those that think anyone can kind of find their own way to God. If they maybe follow some of the rules, if they keep the Ten Commandments, if they just try not to murder, they might be good. This offends people who think that I can find my own way to God. being just a good person is enough. The gospel tells us it isn't. And finally, the last way that the gospel offends is that it tells us that salvation was accomplished by Jesus' suffering and serving, not his conquering and destroying. So this is especially relevant for Paul's audience in the book of Romans. He's talking to both Jews and Gentiles. So a lot of the rub with Jews and accepting Christ as the Messiah was that he didn't come conquering and destroying as this awesome king who just kind of, you know, swept through, and he came as a suffering servant. And this is offensive because it offends people who want their salvation to mean an easy life. They want their salvation to make their life safe and comfortable. And oftentimes, if you've been a believer for any period of time, you know that it brings the greatest joy. Salvation in Christ certainly changed my life and brought joy to my life, but it didn't alleviate all suffering. It didn't alleviate my need to serve others and be self-sacrificing. So this offends people who want the gospel to be a fix-all and just make everything better immediately, which often involves suffering and serving as it did for Christ. But Paul is not ashamed. So despite all these ways that the gospel is shameful, and especially to the Jews and the Gentiles that he was talking to, he was not ashamed of the gospel. And why? We see that in verse 17. Because it is the power of God for salvation for all who believe. In the gospel, God has brought us into right standing with him. The gospel is not merely a concept or a philosophy. The gospel is words and power come together. The message of the gospel is what God has done for us and will do for us. And he doesn't say that the gospel brings power or has power or contains power. He says that the gospel is power. It lifts people up. It transforms. When the gospel is proclaimed and thought about and reflected upon, its power is released. It's powerful because it does what no other power on earth can do. It can save us. It can reconcile us to God and guarantee that we will dwell with him forever. So there's certainly great news for everyone in this room today, and that's that God became a man to save humanity, to save you from your sins, and to bring us into right standing and fellowship with him, to glorify him forever. And if you're here and you're not a believer, if you hear that gospel and you don't get it or believe it, keep asking questions. I hope that as you hear the story of the gospel, that you'll strive to learn and ask questions and discover who Jesus is and what he's done. And if you're here and you do believe in Jesus, if you hear this gospel proclaimed and you say, yes, that's what saved me, that's what I trust in, I hope that hearing the gospel and seeing it daily will encourage you to live unashamed of the gospel as Paul is, realizing that it's the power of God for salvation for all who believe. So I want to turn for our last few minutes here to some practical things. So we've heard, okay, this is the gospel, and we are to proclaim it unashamedly. We're to realize that it is certainly a shameful message for non-believers. It's not usually the most uplifting thing to tell someone that they're a sinner and worthy of eternal punishment. That's not the most joyful message in the world. But we proclaim it because it has power. So I want to talk through some practical things, because how do we go about this gospel proclamation? Certainly we can yell it in people's faces and share the gospel, but this isn't always the most effective way to do it. You could probably put a megahorn on your car and drive down the 13 out here, and that might be one way. But I want to present to you something that we've put before our student leaders to think about when planning events or activities for our collegiate ministry at Delaware. And what this does is it essentially categorizes people. This is the spiritual state of people in your life. And it helps us think about where people are in their faith or their kind of disposition towards Christianity, really to help better reach them. And this is something that we use on campus with college students, but it certainly applies to anyone. It's certainly something that you could be thinking about people in your life. So these are kind of the five spiritual categories that we've assigned to anyone on campus, anyone really in the world, in terms of their spiritual disposition. So zero up there, M0, is those who are already in the Christian fold. So when you're thinking through your church, this is pretty much probably everyone here. These are people that, they're the ones who will show up regardless. So when you, post a church event or host a Bible study, these are probably the people that you might assume would be there. M1 is the next kind of level. These are people who are churched, who might have grown up in churched, but they're pretty disaffected by the church. They might be actively spiritual. If you ask them what they believe in, they might say, yeah, I'm a Christian. But they're not necessarily religious. They're not going to show up to a service if no one invites them. They're kind of on the fence. They have questions, but their minds are open, not closed. They're willing to give it a shot. They're willing to have a conversation about their Christianity or spirituality with you. M2, this is the generally silent and apathetic toward Christianity group. And in reality, this is likely the biggest group, in the U.S., I would say. These are people that they're not necessarily against us and what we believe in, but they're also not just going to waltz in on a Sunday morning. They're willing to listen, but they often find these religious conversations pretty irrelevant. They could take it or leave it. M3 is the next level here. These are the suspicious and skeptical. They might be reacting to negative examples in the church. They might have had a bad church experience in the past and be pretty skeptical of believers. But they might be willing to give you some time to discuss. But these discussions might not necessarily be nice discussions. There might be a little bit of pushback here. And finally, M4, these are people with, they're active in beliefs or religions that are very negative toward Christianity. So these are people that are in a different religion maybe and very, very against Christianity. These are kind of the hardcore atheists or agnostic people who are just waiting for a Christian to approach them so they can start the fight. So within this group, we, both as a campus ministry and I think as the church in general, we lean toward reaching those in that M1 to M0 zone. And we may have great success because in these situations, the culture has kind of done the prep work for us, right? Like it's easy to invite someone to church who is either kind of already a believer or is kind of familiar with what goes on here because it's not a confusing place for them to walk into. These people have some experience with the gospel, and what we're doing here is kind of taking them the last mile. And the challenge of kind of moving past that M1 to M0 is the cultural difference. What we're doing here this morning, where you're all sitting and listening to me speak, it's kind of a strange thing for a lot of people to stand up and sing songs. It seems normal to those who have been in church for a good amount of time, but anyone in this other category, it's going to seem like just a strange thing. So I want to go through these groups and talk about, okay, we've seen how these are kind of broken out, but how do we reach these groups? How do we actively think of ways to reach everyone? Because like I said, this M2 is probably the largest majority of people in your community. So what are we doing to reach them? So first thinking through M0 and M1, because like I said, this is kind of what the church does best at reaching. But that's not to say these people aren't important. These are valuable members of our community. So for your church service or your small groups, once again, these will be the first ones to come and the most faithful. And we're not saying that ministry isn't essential to M0s, but rather that these are the people that we need to take the last mile. This is where discipleship is crucial. We can't have these people just wandering around and treating the church as their social club. These are people who need to be discipled to make more disciples. And I think what this really involves is challenging them. These might be some people who are comfortable. They come every Sunday, and it's a comfortable and enjoyable place to be. But we need to be challenging folks like this to go outside of their comfort zone. And also a quick note, this group is certainly shifting as our culture shifts. So it's becoming not quite as defined as to who are in this group that are already in the Christian fold, because the definition of what it means to be a Christian is changing for a lot of people. M1 is the, once again, the church, but not, but disaffected, not really all in. Usually these people are best reached through friendship evangelism. So I'm sure all of you have people in your life who would claim to be believers, would probably say that, yeah, I'm a Christian, but there's not much evidence there. There's not much fruit. They're not really involved in a local church. They're not sharing the gospel. They're not probably not reading their Bible. So these are the people that we just befriend with. These are the people that we invite into our community. And we start to ask these questions about our community. Are we open or are we a closed community? Are we a social club who just comes together and doesn't reach out to others? Are we hidden or are we visible to others? Do people know that we're here? And are we existing for ourselves or are we existing for people like this that surround us? The next category is, like I said, probably the biggest category and probably the hardest to engage. And this is really because they're not hot or cold to the gospel. People who are, you know, excited about the gospel, we can reach them because all we have to do is kind of throw out a Bible study and they might come. And the people who are on the other side and, you know, are anti anything involving Christianity, well, we can throw out a Bible study and they might come just to argue. But this group, they're neither hot nor cold. And most events aren't really aimed toward this group. If you think through, you know, a pizza party or a Bible study or a general outreach, they don't really care either way. They're not going to come to a Bible study. But if we're thinking through like apologetics events, and kind of high profile speakers, they're not coming to that either. That's going to be the M3, M4 group. So the problem with M2s is that they're the only ones that aren't really interested in talking. So rather than continuing to speak to them in our language, these are people that we need to start to speak to them in our language, in their language. And often on a college campus and in a community, really, this happens through service. So part of God's redemptive purpose in the world is things done for the good of our community and for the world around us. So when we do these things sincerely, when these people see that, man, they really believe what they're preaching, we start to build bridges. And when we serve these friends in practical ways, it begins to open doors. And finally, the last group, the M3, who are suspicious and skeptical, and the M4, who are kind of actively against. We're kind of group these into the same group. And just a side note, I think oftentimes, especially Christians tend to think that like this is the huge group. I think we have that impression, especially on a college campus. A lot of our students tend to think that everyone's out to get me and they're ready to pounce on me if I try to share the gospel. Usually people aren't. This isn't like the majority of the group, even though it might seem like it at times. But with M3s and M4s, we need to be willing to play the visiting team. And what this means is that sometimes we just listen. Sometimes we're not just out to get the gospel in immediately. Sometimes we're playing that out a little longer and listening to what these people have to say. A question to ask, how are we thinking of these people? Are they trophies to be won or are they people to be loved? Because I think oftentimes, you know, talking to someone who's a hardcore atheist, like the idea of converting them can be like a trophy to put in our trophy case of I won the argument, I won that person over. Are we thinking of them as trophies to be won or people to be loved? Because they're in need of grace just as we are, right? They're just people like us, and I think we're probably more similar to people in this group than we think. Another way to think outside the box, your church isn't bound to the same events every year. Certainly, I'm sure there are things that you do that go well and serve the community well and serve the body well. But especially in our engagement with non-believers, this should be changing because, well, the culture's changing. And finally, the last way, we need to stand out with this group. We need to treat others differently. Many of these people have had probably bad experiences with Christianity. And I think the best way to go about thinking through treating them differently is humility. We need to show our weakness. We can't be afraid to say, I don't know. I'm sure you've been asked that tough theological question that you haven't really thought through. It's okay to say, hey, I don't know. Can we get back together and talk about that later? I'm going to talk to my pastor. I'm going to, you know, read some books on that. We can't be afraid to say, I don't know, to this group. And we also can't be afraid to apologize. There's a quote somewhere, I don't remember where it came from, I've heard it for a while. Maybe it was something that Blake told me, it probably was. But I've always heard that we should be close enough to unbelievers to sin against them. We should have relationships with people who aren't Christians that are tight enough that we might get angry at them. We might, you know, make a commitment and forget about it. We should be sinning against unbelievers, not because we want to, but because we have those relationships where our humanity comes into play. But when we do, we should be quick to apologize and make amends. We should be an example of what it looks like to have real relationships where things get messy sometimes. So people outside of Christianity can call us a lot of things, but we shouldn't give them room to call us arrogant or hypocritical. So, as I said, these are all ways that can help us think about college students. This is the way that we encourage our leaders to think about college students. But they very much apply to the local church because, as you probably know, college students are also the local church. They're a group of the local church, but this can be used to think about anyone in your community that you're aiming to serve. Because college ministry doesn't function outside of local church involvement. We saw that this morning with the state missions offering, and we're grateful for that and the ways that that goes to benefit collegiate ministry throughout the state. And I'm thankful to, I sat in with the Sunday school class this morning who's doing ministry on Del State's campus, and it's awesome to see local churches realizing that college students aren't just another kind of, I don't know, program or we need to make sure we're hitting all these points, but you're realizing that, hey, they're right there. And we're right here, so how are we serving the community around us? So thank you for your willingness to embrace college students as a part of your community. And I pray that you will, like Paul, be unashamed of the gospel and eager to reap that great harvest in your community here in Dover.